today, number 98-1591, Strasser versus Transtech Mobile Fleet Service. Appearing for the Strassers is Robert B. Erdman. Mr. Erdman.
Good morning. May it please the court. I represent the plaintiffs Thomas and Sandra Strasser, appellants in the lower court, petitioners before this court. The petitioners, Thomas and Sandra Strasser, asked this court to find that the doctrine of open and obvious danger does not bar the Strassers' claim for injuries. They also request this court to find the case of Rolfe versus EBI, 159 Wis Second, 518, is inapplicable to the facts. Briefly, the background of this case is Thomas Strasser was employed with Recycled Fibers of Wisconsin. His duties included operating a semi with a flatbed trailer attached to it. On the flatbed trailer was mounted a crane. Mr. Strasser used this crane in order to obtain recyclable materials from various locations around the city of Milwaukee area. He would go to a location and he would then climb to the top of the crane about 13 feet above the platform. He would sit in an operator's seat there and use that crane to pick up bales and put them onto the flatbed for return to recycled fibers. His means of getting on to this crane were by one of two ladders that were located on either side of the crane. Over time, these ladders became worn and were beyond repair. And Thomas Strasser's employer requested Daryl Frick, who was operating as Transtech Mobile Fleet Service, to make a repair of the ladders. But because they were beyond repair, Frick, at the request of Recycled Fibers, fabricated new ladders. These ladders were constructed by Frick approximately 2 weeks before Thomas Strasser fell. The issue of the application of the open and obvious danger doctrine arose out of Frick's failure to install safety treads on the rungs of these ladders, and Strasser's continued use of the ladders for the two-week period prior to his fall. The appellate court held that Strasser accepted the ladder in spite of the missing safety treads, and that this acceptance, along with two admitted instances of slipping, albeit he was not injured in those instances, on the ladder prior to being injured, were sufficient to take this case from a jury and find that Thomas Strasser was more negligent than Frick as a matter of law. I think it's also important to note here that Thomas Strasser was basically a crane operator. He was working for Recycled Fibers and had to use this rig as part of his job every day. And I think it's also important to note before the court that although there may have been two occasions where he did slip prior to the fall, in the process of using this rig every day, he was going up and down those ladders dozens and dozens of times without incident.
Counsel, just on the facts itself, I just want to clarify something. Basically, as I understand it, the repair company or the fabrication company did not have either the ability or the know-how to install the safety, flat tread. Is that incorrect as far as my understanding?
I believe that the record shows that Frick knew what the safety treads were, but expressed concern about his ability to get those safety treads. I think there is some testimony on point. Contained in the deposition testimony of Daryl Frick. In Frick's videotaped deposition, beginning on page 38 at lines 25, it begins with, "He initiated a call to you. Mr. Marzo initiated a call to you. And then continuing on page 39, I don't remember if I talked to him personally or on the phone, but yes, he initiated that. And he said, look, we're having trouble with these ladders. They keep coming loose and we need something sturdier. Is that correct? Yes. And at that time, do you recall and have testified that Mr. Marzel said, and we want you to put some stair treads on the rungs to make them safer. Is that correct? I'm not sure that's his testimony, terminology, but yes, he had requested that I put something on for the stair treads. Yes. Well, whether he used the specific words stair treads or extruded or extended metal, you understood that he wanted a covering over the rungs that would be safer, would be rough, so that an individual using the ladder would get a firm grip on the rung as they went up and down the ladder. Is that correct? That's correct. Is that your understanding of what Mr. Marzel requested? Yes, it is. And if I can add, well, then it goes on, then I wanted to add to that on page 40 at lines 24. Did Mr. Marzel indicate in that conversation to you at that time prior to the commencement of the job that it was okay with him that you didn't put a stair tread on the rungs? He was informed that I may not be able to get the stair treads at that time. This may not inform part as a little problem for me. He was informed that I may not have the stair tread. This part that you said to Mr. Marzo about may not be able to get the stair tread. In other words, you didn't say, I cannot get the stair tread. Right. So during the conversation, there was at least the inference that you might be installing the stair tread. Is that correct? Yes. Did Mr. Marzo indicate to you at that time that he felt that the stair tread was important to the installation of the ladder? Yes. The appellate court's reasoning is wrong on the application of the open and obvious danger doctrine because there is missing sufficient evidence of a public policy to warrant taking this case from a jury. The appellate court is wrong because the decision directly conflicts with the application of the comparative and contributory negligence statutes. The appellate court is wrong because this court has repeatedly held that the open and obvious danger doctrine amounts to an abrogation of comparative negligence principles and will be only applied in very narrow instances. Ironically, in the appellate court reasoning, however, the petitioner believes there is the correct reasoning on this case, as was noted by Justice Curling in her concurring opinion that she found that the open and obvious danger doctrine was not applicable to this case. And regarding another question in this case as to the applicability of the Roth case, I agree, and the petitioner agrees with the reasoning of Judge Shipson in the opinion of the majority that Roth is inapplicable to these facts. As Justice Wilcox said in Rockwaite versus Seneca, 197 with second 409, in the ordinary negligence case, which I believe this case is, if an open and obvious danger is confronted by the plaintiff, it is merely an element to be considered by the jury in apportioning negligence and will not operate to completely bar the plaintiff's recovery. And this sound reasoning has already been applied at the appellate level by Judge Kane in Wagner versus Wisconsin Municipal Mutual Insurance Company, 230 with second 633.
Mr. Erdman, let me interrupt you, if I might, for a minute. Why is this an ordinary negligence case rather than a products liability case? I think you know that a number of the cases have drawn a distinction between ordinary negligence and products liability cases in regard to the open and obvious doctrine. Why do you feel that this fits within the ordinary negligence, not the products liability situation?
I think if you look at the facts that are before the court, What you have here is a relationship between two companies over a long period of time. A relationship that lasted for a couple of years, in which the one company, the company that Frick worked for, did all the maintenance that was necessary for the other company, performing primarily services for that company. And on one occasion, he was asked to perform a service. And actually, on previous occasions, he would have been asked to perform similar service, which is repair. He was doing a repair. What happened in this case was that the repair became more extensive than the parties would have originally thought, because the ladders themselves became so obsolete that they were no longer repairable. So Frick went ahead and made the new ladders.
Well, aren't you making two different arguments depending on whether you're talking about Rolfe or you're talking about open and obvious? It seems to me that what you've been saying up to now in your brief and also your oral argument is that Rolfe isn't applicable, and it isn't applicable because TransTech is not really a reconditioner. They're really a manufacturer. Isn't that your argument here? That they fabricated these new ladders, that this was not a repair, but brand new ladders?
I don't think it's necessary to characterize TransTech as a manufacturer. I've actually called them a mechanic and a repairman, and I think that that's a proper characterization. I think it's the same thing as a repairman working on your automobile.
Did they repair these ladders?
I believe that Frick testified in his deposition that on previous occasions he had made repairs to those very same ladders, but on this occasion he was unable to repair them any further, and so after discussion with Recycled Fibers by Tom Marzo, decided to replace them with new ladders.
Well, new, he fabricated, and when you say new, he took these, as I understand it, he welded pieces together so that they had the handles and they go up in the rungs and walk up. So
correct.
It would be more like a, that's why I asked the question on the, basically on the fabrication or whatever, manufacture, whatever you want to call it, of the ladder.
Yes, that's true. I do actually have some concern with making a distinction, though, on the basis of the open and obvious doctrine as to whether it is applicable to these facts, even if you cast it in the light of products liability. Because I don't think that even on those terms you can say that there are sufficient public policy consideration here to warrant its imposition in this case. As I said, I think that the reasoning of Justice Kane in the Wagner case is, and his analysis of the open and obvious doctrine is very on point. In that particular case, the plaintiff in that case had walked over an icy surface, an icy sidewalk, in the process of doing his job for the Salvation Army at least three, if not four times. He knew that the sidewalk was slippery. He obviously understood that he could slip on the ice. He used a hand cart the first several times and changed his method by taking a load and putting it on his shoulder, and as he was doing that, on his fifth attempt, he slipped and fell. In deciding that the plaintiff was not subject to the doctrine of open and obvious danger, Judge Kane, in his analysis, reviewed the cases, including Supreme Court cases, applying that doctrine. And he termed that those cases, he found those cases to be exceptional cases, where it was clear and uncontroverted that one party was substantially more negligent than the other, and that no reasonable jury could reach a conclusion to the contrary. And Judge Kane noted some examples of those cases, and I think that it bears repeating some of those examples here, because it shows how they're really different from this case. He noted, for example, the diving cases, diving into water of unknown depth, the Sheeler versus Barr case, the murky lake, and then the pool cases, which I guess have been cast as products cases, but also applying this doctrine in the same manner. The Griebler case and Wisnicki case, where the water is of unknown depth or opaque. And he cited the Johnson versus Gradusky case, which is an elevator case where the plaintiff actually disabled the safety device on a braking system so that the elevator would descend more rapidly. And in that case, the plaintiff was found to have encountered an open and obvious danger. The Schilling case, which is the inherent danger of handling a loaded and cocked gun. I would actually add to this list another case, and it was another case where the opinion was written by Justice Kane, and that's the Hartlandy case, where the plaintiff was electrocuted, and the court found that that was subject to the doctrine of open and obvious danger. I think that those cases share something in common that is different from this case, and also different from the Wagner case. In those cases, you're talking about either an instrumentality, say a gun, or a property like electricity, that on the face of it, it's clear to all, using a reasonable man test, that this is dangerous. And anyone that goes further than that goes further at his peril. The elevator case. Elevators are constructed in vertical shafts of varying heights, and they can be quite high. To actually disable a braking device on an elevator, I mean, that really defies logic, and that's reckless. I think everybody could understand the danger of doing something like that. And even going back to the water cases, even though water is something that we're used to having around us and swimming in and using in all kinds of capacities, but to get up over a pool of water, whether it be a lake or over a pool, and not know the depth of it, and then attempt a dive into it, I don't think that's any different than attempting to dive onto concrete.
Okay, counsel. You say this is a negligence case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. What is the negligence? That is, what is the standard of care that the defendant here did not meet?
The standard of care that the defendant did not meet in this case is that he did not follow the request to put on the safety treads, and that the lack of those safety treads were the cause of Thomas Strasser slipping off the ladder. So the standard of care is that under the circumstances that this was in a contract setting, that he should have followed the contract. And actually, this is a case that I think has been part of the principles of the law of Wisconsin for a long time and is covered by the situation in Colton versus Folks.
All right. The defendant argues, and I'm going to come back to that, but I just want to put it on the table. The defendant argues that you're changing your theory, which may be fine. The defendant says you came into this case arguing a negligent design and manufacture and the failure to warn. And that so I'm just going to, for the moment, I'm going to say this negligent design and manufacture may be like, very much like, failing to put on the treads. So that even if you don't say he's a manufacturer, but a repairer. Now, are you still alleging failure to warn? I mean, is that a standard of care? Sometimes it would be. If you know there's a danger let's say you know there's a danger, then you would be negligent, or somebody would be negligent, if knowing the danger, they failed to warn, right? And that's one of the restatements says, too, recognized tort, negligence, cause of action, right?
Correct.
Now, in the restatement, where they talk about the failure to warn, they say, well, the duty of care is a failure to warn when it's latent or hidden. That you don't have the standard of care is not to warn about something that is open and obvious. I mean, you don't have to warn an adult crossing a street here that cars may be coming. It's open and obvious. On the other hand, if there is a big hole that's covered by some lightweight material, it's not evident that there's a big hole there, and the community, somebody knows it, you'd have to warn, because that would be negligent not to warn. Right?
Correct.
Are you following that?
Yes.
Okay. In the amicus brief of, I think it's the Civil Trial Council of Wisconsin, takes the position that you have to look at open and obvious in two respects. One, ordinary negligence, and maybe they give you that we shouldn't have a difference for landowners and we shouldn't have a difference for manufacturers' products liability. About, okay, name that open and obvious in those conditions, those kinds of cases deal with contributory negligence, that the plaintiff has to exercise due care for himself, herself, right?
Yes.
And that's what you're saying here, and that would be ordinarily a fact question for the jury, right?
That's correct.
Okay. But under a duty to warn case, where that's the negligence, that is the failure to warn, then open and obvious comes in at what is the standard of care and has it been breached. And I'm asking you whether you agree with the Civil Trial Council of Wisconsin.
I don't, Your Honor, because I still believe that this is a, even in the failure to warn, that this is a case that should be decided by the principles of comparative negligence, and that the case law justifies this, and it's not even, I don't feel it's actually an extension of the case law. I think it's just simply a clarification that this court has said that normally you look to the duties of both parties and you compare those duties, and this is ultimately a question for the jury to decide.
You disagree with the restatement?
Well, I don't think that the restatement in this regard is the law of Wisconsin if on a duty to warn. I believe that the law of Wisconsin is that you must compare the negligence of both parties, and unless, because we are a pulse graph state and we start with the premise that everyone owes a duty to everyone else, that you have to find evidence of public policy before you're going to relieve the defendant of culpability in this case. And so under that analysis, I think it's just part of the question of fact for the jury to decide, and that the plaintiff should not be barred for that reason.
Even if you win on open and obvious, why don't you lose on Rawls?
I think the difference is that in the, it's one of public policy. And in fact, Justice Wilcox in the Rockwaite case laid out the six factors that he, or considerations that should go into deciding whether or not to relieve the defendant of culpability.
Let me re-ask the question. I'm not sure I made it clear. How do you distinguish Rolfe from your case?
In Rolfe, that's the case of whether a repairman, reconditioner, has a general duty to bring a product up to current safety standards. And for public policy reasons, this court has held that that is too great an obligation, that, as the court said in that case, would be entering a field where there is no sensible stopping point. The plaintiff petitioner would concede that some aspects in the facts resemble the Rolfe case. In our case, Frick is a repairman. But the difference between Rolfe and this case is that Frick was specifically asked to put the safety treads on. If Frick had put the safety treads on the ladder, I believe this case would have, and if Strasser had still been injured, then I would agree that Rolfe applied here, and that then Frick would then not be subject to culpability in this case. But I think the key to this case is the fact that he had been requested to put these treads on. This is a negligent workmanship case, and I believe that as I had noted earlier, I was about to say that the case is governed by the case of Colton versus Folks.
Before you get to that, so that's the quintessential difference between this case and Roll, that he was specifically asked to put this type of safety tread on. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What if he'd been asked to put something to make it safer on those rungs. And not specifically this raised tread or whatever term they used.
A general idea, can you just make this thing better?
Can you make this step safer? Without giving specific direction as to the type of tread.
I think it might be subject to Rolf at that point.
So the difference here is if he had said, put on a tread to make it safer, it's subject to Rolf. But here he said, put on a specific type of tread, and it's not subject to Rolf. Is that your position?
Well, actually, I may have misunderstood your question, Justice. What I was contemplating was a general, can you make it safer, request.
If he had,
I think if it's a specific request to put something on, you don't put it on, then I think it's governed by Colton v. Folks.
If he had said, what's the duct tape? If he had said, put on some duct tape, that's supposed to cure everything, because it'll give it some... because it'll give it some texture. If that's what the facts of this case were, put on some duct tape and he didn't, would it be covered by Rolf or not?
You know, I think it'd be covered just generally by whether or not you could even cause somebody's injury that way by making such a ridiculous request. Duct tape wouldn't be the kind of idea, wouldn't be something that people would understand to have the abrasive properties, and that's what this is about. These treads, which everybody understood, were...
Masking tape.
It wouldn't be enough.
Velcro.
It wouldn't be enough. I think
well,
you need something clear and specific that has a quality of safety about it.
Okay. Mr. Erdman, Justice Babbage has a question.
You stated here just a moment ago that Frick had been asked to put these on. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, on page 18 of Mr. Simpson's brief, he says this, quote, Strasser testified he never asked Frick to bring the ladder into compliance with any specific safety standards or rules. Frick never indicated he would evaluate or correct any problems that might exist with the ladder design used by the original manufacturer. Do you take any exception to that paragraph?
Yes. The whole point here is that Strasser did ask. Actually, Marzel, the record is that Marzel requested the safety treads.
In a little note or something?
It's actually contained in the portion of the deposition that I first read in answer to Justice Crook's question, in which Marzel actually made the request for the safety treads. That was a conversation between Marzel and between Frick. And then if you looking at the decision of the appellate court, where another portion is of the deposition of Frick is actually included there, it shows some of the interaction between Frick and Strasser, in which Strasser, too, requested the safety treads. So there were two different individuals that were requesting safety treads from Frick.
Seeing and hearing no further questions, counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Simpson, representing TransTech Mobile Fleet Services, Inc.
For the record, I firmly believe that duct tape cures everything. Good morning. Arthur Simpson appearing for TransTech Mobile Fleet Service, Inc. and Heritage Mutual Insurance Company. We're here this morning on three specific issues that need to be addressed with respect to this appeal. The first is the Rolf case, which has been discussed. We are a reconditioner, reconstructor. It was conceded by Mr. Erdman that we are a repair person entitled to the rule under the Rolf case. Our position at the trial court level and as a concurring opinion indicated at the Court of Appeals is that the Rolf case controls here. We have no duty to redesign this ladder. We have no duty to update it unless we specifically hold ourselves out as meeting safety standards, as the term is used in the Rolf case, or we are asked to do so. We do not have either of those situations here. The exceptions to Rolfe, and therefore the Rolfe case controls this appeal, as the concurring opinion indicated.
Your counsel just 2 minutes ago said you were asked.
I'm sorry?
Your opposing counsel 2 minutes ago said that Transtech was asked to put these treads on the stage.
Well, I want to get into the heart of that. That's going to be the central thrust of the issue here. There's a tremendous factual dispute here as to what the record indicates. There was no contract ever made, and there was never an argument about contract until we got to this court. It was a suggestion, it was a recommendation, it was a discussion. It's become a contract at this point in time as we've gone through this matter. The strongest evidence that they have to present on that record was what, on this record, was what was provided in response to Justice Crook's question. The testimony, and I believe I have it here, was that there was some conversation with Marzo. By the way, there is no affidavit or record from Mr. Marzo. There is no evidence from Mr. Marzo presented in this record. The claim was that there was some conversation, and Daryl Frick's response was, well, I may not be able to get stair treads or safety treads. That's the claim that's being made. The response came, what they wanted was a sturdier ladder, something that had a rougher surface on it. That's what the record indicated. There is no indication here that there was a contract to get these so-called safety treads or stair treads. More than that, when this ladder was delivered, Mr. Strasser was told, according to his testimony, the testimony that's cited in our brief, Mr. Strasser was told that Frick did not have this material. That's something the Court of Appeals seized on and referred to directly in their opinion concerning this matter. We didn't have the material. The ladder was given back to Strasser. Strasser said the ladder was fine. He then went off, and the evidence suggests that he slipped or he had problems with it for a couple of weeks, that he was complaining, but he was complaining to recycled fibers about it. Mr. Frick and Transtech knew nothing of these so-called problems until after the accident happened and a lawsuit was filed. I asked the court to search this record for this so-called contract or representation that we were going to put safety treads on. There simply is no evidence of that. That puts us under the Rolfe case, and that ends this case at that point in time. That's the first point we're here to address. Second point deals with the concept of open and obvious doctrine, and there seems three options that exist with respect to that. Number one, that it is a bar under certain circumstances to an entire case. Number two, sort of an intermediate position, that is that the open and obvious doctrine is a tool to be used in duty to warn cases. And the common sense proposition that you don't have to tell somebody not to shoot a loaded gun, for example. In this case, you don't have to warn somebody. Mr. Strasser's claim at this point, although he did give a statement right after this accident indicating that the ladder was oily and there was water on it, and that's why he fell. His position at this point is that the ladder was, the stair treads were an issue, the ladder was slippery in the weeks after Mr. Frick modified the ladder. This is a condition that he seems to acknowledge he knew about. The question becomes, do we still have to have a trial over whether there's a duty to warn someone about something they're fully aware of?
Well, he's moved away from that as the negligent issue.
Well, so we're here, and that's the, I guess that's the second position that could have been taken with respect to open and obvious. If that's abandoned, then we just have the question of whether this gets rid of the entire case or not. It's still before us.
Well, he's alleging that the negligence is that there were no adequate treads on this.
The claim, as I understand it, is that they're now claiming that there was some contract to put these treads on. The treads weren't put on, and therefore that, in addition to what would technically be a breach of contract to recycle fibers, is a negligent act as well. Mm-hmm. And the question is whether or not that would be an open, obvious danger situation, assuming the court gets around the Rolfe issue, which I frankly believe is determinative on the merits of the overall appeal.
What's the difference between a repairer, a reconditioner, somebody who comes in and redoes this whole ladder?
Not much. The Rolfe decision seemed to lump them all together. Somebody that does repair work, somebody that fixes something, they are within that the scope of that particular definition. It was a fairly broad-based definition for that type of a person.
Wasn't this, in effect, a totally new ladder?
Well, and I guess that raises an interesting issue as to how you're going to construe Rolfe. My understanding was they were agreeing that we fit within that particular scope of a reconditioner or whatever the other term was. Reconditioner is the one that I have in mind at this point. The question then becomes, if you're going to take that tack, how do you apply, what are you saying here? That, well, if you come in and you do a partial repair as a small repair person of a manufacturer's product, well, then you're entitled to protection under the Rolfe rule, but if the manufactured product is so messed up that you have to replace it, then you lose that protection. Intellectually, I don't see a difference there. Why my repair person should all of a sudden have the duties vested upon him of a manufacturer designer of that particular product, which is a ladder in that particular application.
Of course, if you're building a new ladder, right, you'd be liable as a manufacturer or a supplier, wouldn't you?
Not if you're, that's the context in which you're building it. If you're building a ladder in retail to sell somebody in retail to go up and down the drive, go up and down at their house to get leaves out of the gutter, perhaps that's one issue. But that then they become an original manufacturer of the product. In this particular set of circumstances, vested with all the duties of an original manufacturer. In this particular case, they're building a ladder under some rather specialized circumstances. The question here is, what's the appropriate design option with respect to a ladder that's used in an industrial application? The problem with the original manufacturer's ladder, as Mr. Mars's testimony indicates, as we cite in our record, was that it was simply not sturdy enough. What they do is they take these large bales of concrete, that would really make it unsteady, cardboard from grocery stores and various other places that get a lot of cardboard that needs to be recycled. They pick it up in large bales and they're slamming it around and they hit these ladders and they weren't sturdy enough, and that was the original problem. The design issue here becomes what sort of ladder is appropriate in that application. There are really three choices. I'm jumping ahead of myself because I'll throw this in at this point. The last issue here is the lack of expert testimony and the issue about just what the standard would be. That being the question, there are several design choices here. The so-called thin rungs, for lack of a better definition, that were on the original ladder that did not suffice. Mr. Frick came up with a second alternative. He put on what everyone agrees, what Mr. Strasser got, were better rungs, were thicker rungs, more steady, and 3/4 of the rung was a threaded pipe. There's about 1/4 of the rung that's not a threaded pipe. What he did was he took a U-bolt that's threaded. He cut the end off the U-bolt, and he's got two pipes, most of which are threaded. That was his response to Mr. Marzo's claim that he wanted some rough surface there in that discussion. And Mr. Strasser admits that this was a so-called better, quote-unquote, ladder than the original ladder. The lament of Mr. Strasser at this point is it's not as good, or, for lack of a better term, should be more better, in that it does not have the treads in place. The question becomes on the liability, on the overall issue here as to the lack of an expert, what is negligence? And I think the Le Cicero case that we cited in our brief discusses that specifically. It's boilerplate law that simply because something better could have been done, that does not create a negligence claim. And that's an issue on which there is no evidence here that it would have been a negligent decision to go with the ladder that Frick had or what would be negligent. This is really an important point that I think the Court of Appeals missed because the majority opinion made a comment that the jurors can figure out that it is more safe to have a ladder with stair treads than not having stair treads. Well, that directly flies in the face of the Le Cicero case, and which we cite in our brief, and the concept that simply because something can be more safe does not mean that the process used was negligent. There is no evidence on that, and that's an alternative basis to affirm the decisions of the trial court and the Court of Appeals here. The example I like to use with respect to that is with respect to an automobile. There's virtually no accident that can't be prevented by making a car more safe. We could all drive around in tanks. If we drove around in tanks, that would be more safe than the cars we're driving around in. But that doesn't make it negligent for the automobile manufacturer to present to the public the cars that they are presenting. That's the same problem that exists with respect to the lack of any sort of safety standard here to establish a basis for liability for Frick and TransTech.
Counsel, on the open and obvious issue, there's something appealing to me about trying to keep it simple. And I define that as, why not just rely on Wisconsin's traditional, we owe a duty to everyone, unless there's a public, I'll put parentheses, unless there's a public policy reason to not impose liability, there's liability.
It's a line in the sand situation. I'm very glad you asked me that question. This court can... One of the problems that we have, I think, in the civil justice system is we have too much time, too much effort, too much court time, lawyer time, litigant time, public time spent on cases of very doubtful merit because of one of my least favorite cliches in the law, summary judgment is a drastic remedy. Well, summary judgment is a drastic remedy, but sending everything to trial is a drastic remedy as well because there are a lot of costs there. What the open and obvious danger rule is or should be is a common sense tool that the trial judges have to serve a gatekeeper function.
Well, you can still, now, there's a difference between open and obvious being a bar to recovery as a matter of law and open and obvious on the individual facts of a case being such a abundance of evidence that the court can rule as a matter of law based on the facts of an individual case and take it from the jury. You understand the difference I'm making?
Not really, but I understand the point you're trying to raise because I've heard it before, but I don't necessarily agree with that concept. If we're going to use the concept of an open and obvious danger, or if you want to put some other rubric on it, I guess you can always put a term on it, but What I think is that there should be some reasonable gatekeeping function performed by the trial judges.
Okay, and that's why I raised this distinction.
Yeah.
One reasonable gatekeeping approach is the trial court, which is the usual approach. Look, if you believe all of their evidence is true as a matter of law, they're still not going to prevail. You know,
sure.
That's gatekeeping. Another gatekeeping is say, hey, we have a legal premise that open and obvious as a matter of law bars recovery, regardless of the individual weighing of facts, whether it be by the jury or the trial court as gatekeeper. Your argument, as I understood it, which elicited this question, is, well, we need a gatekeeper. We're going to have frivolous litigation. And I respond to you, well, then can't the gatekeeper be, as it oftentimes is, the trial court assessing whether or not there are sufficient facts to go to the jury as opposed to a legal premise that you're barred as a matter of law?
Okay, well, I think that whether we're talking open and obvious danger or whether we're talking... throw that term out the window and just use a situation, I'm sorry. Throw that term out the window and just use a situation where you weigh the facts and perform the gatekeeper function is largely a matter of syntax. That is, what we really need and what open and obvious danger is sort of a rubric, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Do you believe that open and obvious should always bar recovery in products cases?
If the danger is sufficiently open and obvious, I guess. And again, that requires a judgment that the trial judge or the fact the trial judge is going to have to make in certain situations. I think that one can legitimately argue that there may be situations where if it's an open obvious danger and it's a potential argument of a manufacturing defect, let's say, there's a legitimate argument that can be made. Well, perhaps the manufacturer should have corrected it just as much as the plaintiff should have looked
out
for it.
It's so obvious to the user, it's obvious to the manufacturer.
I mean, I think there could be situations like that, but I think it's really a fact-intensive situation. I don't want to give you I can imagine a situation where that would be a fair and appropriate outcome. But I don't want to give you a hard and fast rule either way.
I know, but you're responding that way, that's why it's unclear to me. It seems to me you're not advocating that open and obvious is always a bar to recovery in products cases. Am I correct?
Well, I don't have a products case today,
okay,
so I'm not confronted with that issue. I am not advocating that.
You're not advocating that open and obvious should always be a bar in failure to warn cases. Is that correct?
Oh, no, I am advocating that. I think it's absolutely ridiculous that if everyone knows this is an open and obvious hazard, that I have to, as a manufacturer or in any type of a defense perspective, tell somebody to watch out for something that we all know exists. I think that in that case, it should be an absolute a bar to recovery. It's just common sense. We don't have to have trials to tell people over whether we should have told somebody to be careful about something that common sense would indicate you should be careful about.
So you agree with the civil trial counsel amicus brief?
That's correct. I think that was a good analysis the way it was presented there, as I recall it. I think that's a very appropriate analysis of open and obvious.
So you'd make a distinction between a duty to warn negligence case and other kinds of negligence cases?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable analysis of the situation. I mean, I just cannot imagine a situation where one can say, as a matter of fact, when I initially briefed this case at the trial court level, that was my open and obvious. I argued with respect to the warning claim. I cannot imagine a case where, if we're going to say this is an open and obvious hazard, that we need to then tell people about it. On the other hand, it is conceivable, and I don't believe my case fits within these facts. Perhaps I should qualify my answer in that way. But I think it is conceivable that there are situations where there could be an open and obvious hazard, that there could be questions about, well, whether this could be designed away or whether there was a manufacturing defect that led to the hazard. Each case would you have to look at more very closely on the facts, and that's not my case today. I don't think it's fair of me to comment on it because I can imagine a million different scenarios, and to just throw down a rule and say once you say the magic words open and obvious, everything goes out the door, and that kind of a claim, I think that's a step that should be taken very carefully.
But on duty to warn.
On duty to warn, I have a different position because I think that's, as I've said before, I think that's the heart of the entire issue.
Just as Babbage has a question. I'm sorry. Go ahead, you may continue, Mr. Okay,
thank you.
How does that play out then? You know, I'm a trial judge and I have trying a case, and of course the cause of action is failure to warn, failure to exercise ordinary care, negligence, there's a number of causes of action. So you're going to say for everything else, you put it in the hopper and say there's reason, you use the reasonable care standard. But for duty to warn,
you just say this is not a warning case. We won't have any evidence. Instructions on warning. If the defense lawyer asks, it could be considered. Whether it be an instruction that there is no basis for liability on failure to warn, you could even, if you want to go that far, you could. I suppose if there had been no evidence on it and it had been precluded, you wouldn't need to go that far. But knowing my colleagues, they probably want that anyway. But I think it could be certainly controlled in that matter. It's a different type of an issue. At least that's my feeling on it. There are two levels that are at issue here, the warning and then the claims about other possible issues. As far as open and obvious and applying to my facts on this particular case, one of the things that was done in the Wegner case was to put the rubric that we need a policy reason down in order to apply open and obvious in all situations. And that seemed to me something of a new condition that was added to application of the open and obvious doctrine. I don't know if... I'm not sure whether we actually need a specific policy reason or what we specifically need, what you mean by a public policy reason in Wegner. The Wegner case was a fall on ice, and I think the problem there was that there was a statute that required the municipality involved to do something about the ice, and so there was an affirmative policy requiring them to do something, which made it very difficult to invoke an open and obvious danger doctrine to preclude recovery. That might be one of the type of situations where, because there is an affirmative policy, you can't apply open and obvious to all claims, as an example of one of the type of claims where that open and obvious might not apply.
Again, that's the duty of care there was to clean up the sidewalk.
I believe that's right. You have 3 days to clean up ice,
right.
If I recall. I don't remember the number or the specifics beyond that.
That was the due care obligation was clean sidewalks. Therefore, you had a breach of that duty since the sidewalk was not clean, or the jury could so find.
Correct.
And that the defense was that the plaintiff should have seen it.
Yeah, the defense was there. The fellow, as I understand, he walked back and forth across this ice 5-6 times, and at one point he was picking up 20 or 30 pounds on a barrel or something, and he carried it over one, decided to just carry it over one shoulder and go across the ice, and he went down and hurt himself. And that was the defense was, well, gosh, you know, the ice was there. You were there looking at it. Do we need to actually have a jury trial on that? And I think that would be a very difficult question if not for that statute that indicated there was a public policy stating municipality has some obligation. If it wasn't for that, I think that the defendant's position would have been much stronger in the Wagner case. My case, I just want to quote, I direct the court to page 8 of the Court of Appeals slip opinion, and they summarize what's important here with respect to open and obvious. Strasser offers no authority to support the proposition he could order new ladders on a short timeline, learn his contractor could not obtain ladder treads within that time, withhold information his company had access to the needed tread material, accept the ladders despite observing they did not have the treads, use the ladders and slip from them, complain about ladders but fail to return them, and then complain the contractor was negligent for failing to install the treads. That's a very fine summary in one paragraph as to why the Court of Appeals decided under open and obvious, using the rubric open and obvious danger, this case isn't going any further.
That sounds to me like the Court of Appeals is saying there's not sufficient evidence and is using the gatekeeper function as, hey, you haven't given us enough evidence, as opposed to a bar, and yet I interpret the Court of Appeals language later on to be a bar.
I found the Court of Appeals decision somewhat difficult to track in a couple of regards, and that's one of them as well. I agree with you. And I think it's an example of what I was talking about earlier. This open and obvious rubric, using the word rubric. It's open and obvious term is one that basically is sort of a buzzword, if you will, for performing a gatekeeper type function. What the court's saying is we're going to screen this litigation, we're going to perform our gatekeeper function, and one of the tools for doing that is open and obvious danger. I agree with you that it's very blurred as to exactly what the Court of Appeals decision says in that regard. But I believe that really comes to the heart of the open and obvious danger rule here and how it should be applied. What we have is a small repair person who fixed these ladders for these people for recycled fibers. There was no complaint about the ladders. They were taken. Everyone acknowledges they were better. And then all of a sudden there's an accident, and we become the design gurus, if you will, responsible for making the correct decisions, even though there's no expert testimony here. All this is a small repair shop trying to fix a busted ladder. And in that type of situation, there is a policy to protect the defendant, a reasonable one, as manifest by what was held in Rolfe and just as manifest by common sense. I've run into a couple, three of these cases, as a matter of fact, I have going at this point, where we have someone who does some repair work or modification of some piece of equipment, and then something goes wrong somewhere down the road, and for whatever reason, we become the target that's involved. And I think there is a legitimate public policy there, which can be guised in the terms of the open and obvious danger, or simply guised in the gatekeeper function. I think what it really comes down to is the best policy thing to do here is to give the trial judges the tools. Not to tell them just to throw your hands up and say summary judgment is a drastic remedy, but rather to look at these cases and to perform a legitimate gatekeeper function to save the public and to save everyone the costs associated with litigation of very questionable claims. And that's really what we're talking about. We talk about a total bar under open and obvious, under the open and obvious doctrine.
Why do you think there was a need for expert testimony here? Why couldn't the jury see the ladder?
because this, there are a number of options here as to what could have been done with respect to this ladder. Number one option was, let's go with the thin rungs that the original manufacturer placed. And I'm sure there would be legitimate argument made that, well, that was fine. That's the product we used. There was nothing wrong with that. That's a legitimate design choice. Number two choice, Daryl Frick puts his ladder out there with the larger treads, with the threaded treads, three-quarters of the way threaded. Everyone says it's a better ladder. Perhaps that's a legitimate choice, and that can certainly be said. Number three choice is apparently some type ladder with, I'm not sure what sort of treads would be necessary, whether they'd be flat, whether they could be rounded, as they were in this case, with some type of an adhesive stair tread on there. That would be the third choice. The question a jury is going to have to decide is, in an industrial application, which is an appropriate choice, which is a reasonable choice.
Why do you need that at summary judgment?
Because the plaintiff has to, it's under the Hunzinger versus Transportation Insurance case, which is at 179 West 2nd. I cannot give you the page off the top of my head. But the plaintiff at some point has to have a case. They have to come forward and put up a case on a motion for summary judgment to show that they have a case, and they haven't done that in this particular case. That's a direct application of that Hunzinger case. Simply put, perhaps a better way to put it is that you just can't wait forever for the case to come forward. If there's a motion brought, you have to show that you have a prima facie case to defeat summary judgment. If you have that, then you have the right to a trial. If you don't, then you're out at that point. And my position is, this is an industrial application. There are a lot of things that I haven't even thought of that could be factored into the choice of ladder. These treads that you glue on, are they going to come off and be hanging down? Is that going to present some kind of a problem? What's the life expectancy of them? That's just one issue I throw out, and I'll tell you, there's nothing in the record about that. There are a lot of issues with respect to designing industrial products, and people devote their lives to it. I think you need some sort of expert testimony to say what was wrong here, what would be negligent. The best they put together is an argument, as the Court of Appeals acknowledged, was that, people would think if you put treads on there, the ladder would be more safe. But that's under the Cicero case. They say it's boilerplate law, and it's always been my position, my understanding of the law. Simply because something might be better doesn't make what's there negligent.
Counsel, I'm still bothered by this duty to warn, with regard to the duty to warn. I think back in the days when we still had invitee and Antonowitz, okay? And then that case came along and said, look, get rid of all of this stuff. Everyone just owes a duty of due care with regard to land. Now, you can have, as we did in those situations, you can have a big, big hole, you can have an empty shaft, and there was no... there could be argued, the landowner should... Now, that's an open and obvious danger. And the law, and Antonio, as we just said in the subsequent cases, we said, just throw it in the hopper, it's ordinary negligence, and discuss whether or not there should have been a warning, whether... I'm putting that in parentheses. And discuss the negligence of each party in the ordinary way that we do in Wisconsin. I mean, those are classic failure to warn cases. I look at, and I just need to hear more from you and test you on this, because okay. I look at the standard, the jury instructions and the comment to 80-20, and the jury instruction committee seems to indicate that the way they interpret it, for what it's worth, although the court in Rockwhite never referred to Griebler, I think that's a swimming pool case decision, the committee interprets Rockwhite to overrule Griebler as to the effect of open and obvious dangers on the responsibilities of plaintiffs and defendants. And that's a classic, duty to warn. The jury instruction committee is interpreting it that we're all in this common pool of it's comparative negligence, throw it in the hopper, everyone owes a duty of due care. Tell me how you can distinguish those cases now. Why on the duty to warn on land, open and obvious, is just ordinary care, but in some other way, the duty to, and on other situations, the duty to warn should have open and obviously a bar to it.
Okay. First point on this is, before we get to failure to warn, I'll just indicate the Rolfe case specifically indicates it applies to any failure to warn claims. So in my particular facts, that's off on the side. That's it's important laying on the side. But coming back to your point, you talk about, I'm trying to get the hypothetical that you have in mind. I think what you're saying is what, if somebody...
Well, let's say a shaft on in the middle of my property,
mm-hmm.
that's open and obvious.
Well, now there, I think there maybe there the facts is where we're having our, that's where we're missing connections. If it's an open and obvious hazard, that is, there's a hole there, oh, I'm walking away again. There's a hole there, and anyone can see there's a hole there, then that is open and obvious, and I don't think that I have any duty under any kind of law to come up to you and say, there's a hole there. And that is a situation, I can't imagine a set of facts where there'd be a duty to warn. On the other hand, and I think this ties with what Chief Justice Abrahamson had to say earlier when Mr. Erdman was answering questions. If that hole is covered or hidden or there's some lightweight material on top of it, then I think that becomes a whole different ball game. At that point, that to me is not open and obvious, first of all. And second of all, then I think there is a duty to warn or a duty to provide something to shield people from that. What I'm saying is there are cases, if we draw the factual conclusion, or the legal conclusion, I guess it would be from the facts, that a condition is open and obvious, at that point, we do not, under any circumstances, find a defendant liable for not telling someone about something that's obvious. And that's the basic simple point that I think would apply with respect to that. My time is up. We would ask that the Court of Appeals be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson.
Mr. Simpson has characterized the relationship between recycled fibers and Transtech Mobile as a very limited relationship in which there was no contract between the parties. And I think that ultimately all of this is something that should have been tried before a jury, but because we're here on a motion for summary judgment, I am forced to look to some portions of the record which I think contradict that and raise the reasonable inference that this case should go to a jury. And I refer to the deposition testimony of Daryl Frick, his videotape deposition testimony, beginning on page 23 at line 20. Say the period of 1993 through 1994, how would you describe your relationship in terms of frequency of visits to recycled fibers? Was it once a month, several times a month, once a week? Several times a day. Several times a day. And were you always working on their trailers and their rigs and their cranes? Constantly. And then further down on page 24, were there any limitations, beginning of line 22, were there any limitations on what you were going to be able to do or not do as far as servicing the trailers? I don't believe so. I mean, anything I could not do mobily, you know, I couldn't do, but pretty much we did everything that needed to be done on them. And this is on page 25. Whatever a trailer needed for repair you would do it? Correct. I think that describes the scope of the relationship between the parties. There were a constant series of agreements and orders that were going on. Elsewhere in the deposition, I know there is references to the fact...
Just to ask, well, that... And it was described as a repair person, and that's just what you read. The idea that I have is that this is like taking a farmer having a business, taking his trucks to the same tractors to the same shop all the time and having them repaired.
Correct.
Are you trying to say that there was some design or some, because there was a special relationship different than you would have between a business and some place that they would take to repair their machinery? Just explain what you're getting at.
What I'm saying is that there was an ongoing relationship between the parties. that was in effect a series of agreements at any particular time of what to do that was governing what that agreement would be. And in this case, on these facts, the agreement between the parties was put safety treads, that both parties knew what were meant by those safety treads, on that ladder, and he didn't do it. And so that is the basis for this case before the court. Mr. Simpson was arguing that an open and obvious danger doctrine can be used as a bar or a tool by the court. Well, I think that just contravenes what we've been talking about here, that this is ordinarily everybody owes a duty to everyone else unless there is a public policy consideration, a substantial and important public policy consideration for relieving a defendant of the culpability in that particular case. And I think that's the principle that needs to be applied to this case. I would like to submit another hypothetical to the court. If this court were to rule that the Rolfe case applies to these facts, I could envision a hypothetical where your repair shop down the block, your auto mechanic, puts the wrong brake shoes on, and your brakes don't function, and you're injured. Should he be relieved of his culpability for his negligent workmanship? Of course not. And that's what this case is about, too. He was supposed to put safety treads on that ladder, and he didn't. And that's what this whole case would have been about at trial, whether or not that failure to do it was a cause of the injuries to Thomas Strasser, and whether Thomas Strasser could have done things to prevent it.
Do you have any other references in the record to support your statement that they were instructed to put safety treads on these ladder steps? Besides the memo of Mr. Marzel.
There was actually reference to the other area made by the appellate court itself in its decision, in which the court quotes a portion of the deposition testimony of Strasser. And may I read that portion? The day that Frick built the ladder, I told him to put stair treads on. And what did he say? I don't have any. And what did you do at that point? There is nothing much I could do. Well, did you tell him to get some? Yes. And he said he couldn't get any? No, he didn't say that. What did he say at that point? He said he didn't know where to get it. Okay, did you know where to get it? Yes. Where was that? The powerhouse of recycled fibers. And did you tell Darrell he could get some of his material at recycled fibers? No, I didn't. Did you tell Darrell that the stairs would be acceptable as he made them? No. What did you do then? I just had to use it. So your position is that you told Darrell that the stairs were acceptable or not acceptable, or you just took it and said nothing, or what? I told him he had to get stair tread or non-slip and put it on the rung. I think that series of questions and answers actually...
You go on to the next page, and there was this question asked from him. After you finished the job, did you consider the job complete? Yes. Did you consider you were no longer required to get the safety tread? Yes, because I asked Strasser if that was suitable for the way it was, and he said yes.
Well, that just raises what, of course, is often raised at the summary judgment stage. We have an issue of material fact in dispute. Let's have a trial and find out which the jury believes, Strasser or Frick. But at this stage, for the purposes of this argument before this court, I think all the inferences should have to be made in favor of Thomas Strasser.
Well, your time has expired, Mr. Erdman.
Thank you.
So I want to thank Mr. Erdman and thank Mr. Simpson for their argument in this case. And this ends the hearing on 98-1581. The court is in recess. And